Hello and welcome to The Sector, the radio show podcast promoting nonprofits, social justice, and activism. Broadcasting here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan Clow, your host. To those listening live, good morning. It's Friday. The weekend is almost here. And to those listening via podcast, well, welcome whatever time it is. We have a great show today. Now, just a reminder that you can download our podcast at our website, sectorpodcast.wordpress.com, and listen live at citr.ca. On today's show, we'll be discussing freedom, but not just freedom, as that's a little vague. Rather, we'll be talking about freedom in relation to society. Now, we all love freedom. We all think freedom is great. We believe that we should all be given the right to determine our own destiny, and that's a central tenet in our democracy here and around the world. It's part of the foundation of progressive activism. People need to be free to make their own decisions. Whether those decisions are about birth control, or who we marry, or what we believe, it's foundational. In this sense, freedom is about the individual being respected and being autonomous. But as proponents of social justice, we also take into account the role of society and the individual's responsibility to the rest of the world. After all, isn't this what a large percentage of the nonprofit sector is all about? Encouraging responsibility to society? Social justice acknowledges that society and civilization can have a drastic impact on individuals. While it might be great for an individual to amass great wealth and power, does society benefit the same? We accept certain limitations on our personal freedom in an effort to make society safer, fairer, and more prosperous. Most of these we accept easily. We, here in Canada, generally accept that police should be the only ones to carry guns. We accept that certain occupations should be regulated and enforced. But how far should our acceptance go? Is there a limit, and can we nail that limit down with specifics? So for today's show, we'll be discussing this issue and what it means to all of us. Last week's big question was on the very topic, so we'll get to some of your feedback soon. We don't have an interview today, so there'll be no pitch of the week, but we will have a new big question towards the end of the show. We'll also take a bit of time to discuss some recent news stories that relate to our central question. Hopefully they'll give us a bit of an insight into this issue and raise some questions. Well, let's take a quick break here on The Sector, and we'll be back with more after this.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's nonprofit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
UBC's Museum of Anthropology displays long-term and visiting exhibits of Indigenous art from around the world, and guided tours are free. Our permanent collection features one of the world's finest exhibits of Northwest Coast First Nations art. Our collection includes 36,000 ethnographic pieces, 535,000 archaeological pieces, and over 600 pieces in the Kroner Ceramics Gallery. There's a lot to take in. Luckily, at the Museum of Anthropology, final exams are always take-home. If you've never checked out this world-class facility, now's your chance. The Museum of Anthropology is located right on campus and free for all UBC students and faculty. Come enjoy our collection and resources.
And we're back on The Sector here on CITR. So, have you changed your password recently? Recently, news broke of the internet security bug Heartbleed. This vulnerability exists in what's called the OpenSSL and is part of the Internet Transport Layer Security Protocol. Now, the exact details are technical and they're not terribly relevant, but the main thing is that because of the Heartbleed bug, potentially millions of users may have had vital personal information hacked or stolen. Many websites around the internet have been making round-the-clock efforts to patch the vulnerability and then encourage all of their users to change their passwords. I'll post a link in our show notes with some more information, including lists of websites affected by the bug. And while not everything was hit, there were some widely used sites such as Facebook, Gmail, and government websites. In fact, the Canadian Revenue Agency has reported that approximately 900 taxpayers had their social insurance numbers stolen as a result of the bug. So if you haven't already, it's a good idea to change your passwords and maybe do some checking to make sure that your banks and other official services that you use haven't been compromised. Now, this isn't just a public service announcement. The issue of privacy has always been front and center when it comes to rights and freedoms. Whether it's a question regarding the ease of access to sensitive information that gets put on Facebook or Twitter or sent via email, or the way that our information gets used by these platforms, sometimes selling that information to third parties or using it to create customized ads, there have been a lot of talk about how much we put out there about ourselves. Of course, it's not just what we put out there, but also who is out there. Spying, espionage, wiretapping, data tapping, whatever term you use, the buzz around the internet is the extent that government agencies are spying / collecting information on us. The NSA gets the lion's share of the rage these days, but it's not just American agencies that spy on people. Other countries, including Canada, have been turning the magnifying glass on their own people. The implications of this are far too wide-reaching to be adequately summed up here and now, but I just wanted to prime you all to get you thinking about our online presence and our desire to protect privacy. There have been a few news stories recently that I wanted to share with you and dive into a bit of this issue regarding freedom and privacy. The first was the recent news that Condoleezza Rice, former Bush administration Iraq war architect and supporter of wiretapping, joined the board of directors of Dropbox, a cloud-based program for sharing files over the internet. So it's a bit of a surprise that Dropbox, a company that asks for your trust every time you use it, sharing potentially private files over the internet, would bring someone like Rice on board their directorate board. Dropbox CEO Drew Houston said this in a statement, quote, "When looking to grow our board, we sought out a leader who could help us expand our global footprint. Dr. Rice has had an illustrious career as provost of Stanford University, board member of companies like Hewlett-Packard and Charles Schwab, and former United States Secretary of State. We're honored to be adding someone as brilliant and as accomplished as Dr. Rice to our team," end quote. And of course, there's already a pretty significant backlash against Dropbox for this move. Many are calling for a boycott, while others are canceling their subscriptions to the cloud sharing service. Temporarily getting back to Heartbleed and information sharing, the immediate question was whether or not organizations like the NSA were exploiting the bug themselves. Bloomberg.com reported that two anonymous sources within the NSA leaked that not only did the NSA know about Heartbleed, they used it themselves to collect information. The NSA promptly denied the story, saying that they never knew about or used Heartbleed. Of course, people aren't exactly inclined to believe professional spies. The accusations that the NSA knew about and used the bug for 2 years prior to its discovery only weeks ago is both an extraordinary claim, which requires extraordinary evidence, but when you have a history of secretly collecting information about people for undisclosed purposes, people may have trouble believing you, even when you're telling the truth. Boy who cried wolf, anyone? Will we ever find out the truth behind the NSA's involvement? Well, unlikely. And what evidence does come to light will most likely be so controversial that it would never hold up in court. So what are we to do with all of this? It would seem that our information just isn't safe anywhere. Should we cancel all of our online social media accounts? Give up social media. Who could do that? But how culpable are we in all of this? We have, without much prodding, provided tons of private information to places like Facebook and Google. Even things like pictures, location check-ins, phone numbers. We would never get this information over the phone. Why do we provide it online? And as some have pointed out, just because Dropbox has Condoleezza Rice on their board doesn't mean that the NSA now has a backdoor key which they can use anytime they want. But maybe we're expecting too much when we send sensitive files over the internet in the first place. If you're using Dropbox to transmit super secret private stuff, wouldn't a briefcase and trench coat be more appropriate? There are a lot of concerned people who consider the privacy issue to be a big problem in today's world. Yet, not everybody agrees. Or at least, there are many who simply don't seem as concerned. Why would that be? The theme of today's show is the balance between freedom and society. Perhaps many have weighed the balance of privacy and security and decided that they're willing to tolerate less privacy if it makes them safer. If we think that letting the NSA or MI6 eavesdrop on conversations and read our emails makes us a bit safer from terrorist attacks, or helps James Bond stop some villain from blowing up a nuclear bomb, maybe that's a trade-off many are willing to make. Why don't we take a quick break here on The Sector? After, we'll discuss last week's big question. Remember, if you want to participate in our big questions, visit us at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com or find us on Facebook or on Twitter at sectorpodcast. We'll be right back.
Jazz is a word that means many different things to many different people. The best definition of jazz that I know of is the jazz show on CITR with yours truly, Gavin Walker. Monday nights, 9 to midnight, with the jazz feature at 11 o'clock. Check us out every Monday.
How best to explain it? You've seen me in X-Men.
Yeah.
The character I am, Professor Charles Xavier. Mm. If you remember, he can control things with the power of his mind. Yeah. And make people do things and see things. So I thought, what if you can do that for real? I mean, not in a comic book world, but in the real world.
All right.
So in my film, I play a man who controls the world with his mind.
Right. That's interesting.
Yeah, for instance, I'm walking along. And I see this beautiful girl, and I think I'd like to see her naked, and so all her clothes fall off.
All her clothes fall off?
Mm, yes, and she's scrabbling around to get them back on again, but even before she can get her knickers on, I've seen everything. You know, I've seen it all.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. We've already seen everything.
Okay. It's a comedy, is it?
No.
Say you want a revolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. Tell me that
And we're back here on The Sector, discussing freedom and social justice here on CITR 101.9 FM. So last week on the show, I asked you our big question. In what cases should public health and safety trump personal liberty? So I gave a couple examples: smoking in public, wearing bike helmets, harm reduction drug policy, or even vaccines. As I mentioned, we all accept some level of limitation in the name of public health and safety. But what are those limits? Should there be any limits? Is it hypocritical to accept some rules and ignore other potential ones? Bike helmets are a classic example. We have people riding bikes all over the place. They fall down, they crack their heads open, and now our publicly funded healthcare system has to look after them. Maybe they have permanent brain damage and will require lifetime treatment. Maybe they won't be able to work anymore and will need income assistance. That entire cost could have been mitigated if they had been wearing a bike helmet. So the rule makes sense, right? Well, what about people who are only riding down the streets, you know, just for 5 minutes? What about the people who want to wear a turban or a headscarf? If they opt out on religious grounds, should their insurance rates go up? This may seem like a minor issue, and I'm sure that history's great philosophers who argued so passionately for human rights would be thrilled that this is where the discussion has gone. But trust me, this is building something. The response to this question is really interesting. Most, if not all, seem to agree that a helmet law is a very low-impact rule. That is, being forced to wear a helmet, even for a 5-minute ride, is so low in the list of priorities that no one should really care. And yet, most, if not all of those people, were more cagey about a law against smoking. This is interesting. Why? Surely smoking is a bigger public hazard than riding a bike. Smoking and its related health hazards are one of the biggest health concerns facing society. Lung cancer, secondhand smoke, the associated lung and respiratory diseases, not to mention the costs associated with treating such conditions. If we tolerate a rule about wearing bike helmets, shouldn't we demand a rule banning smoking? Here in Canada, we actually have it written into our charter that the government has the power to limit our freedoms with laws. When the government has limited an individual's right, there is an onus upon the Crown to show the balance of probabilities. Firstly, that the limitation was prescribed by law, namely that the law is attuned to the values of accessibility and intelligibility. And second, that it is justified in a free and democratic society, which means that it must have a justifiable purpose and must be proportional. The primary test to determine if the purpose is demonstrably justifiable in a free and democratic society is known as the Oakes test. The test is applied once the claimant has proved that one of the provisions of the Charter has been violated. Therefore, the onus is on the Crown to pass the Oakes test. In short, the Oakes test asks 3 points. And in order for the limitation to be upheld, it has to meet the requirements. First, it has to be prescribed by law. This means that the limitation must be legal. It must be part of a law, a statute, or a regulation that is within the jurisdiction of the level of government that passed it. Two, it has to be pressing and substantial. The government must prove that the objective of the law is pressing and important. In other words, the purpose of the law must be important to society. And three, proportionality. The concept of proportionality refers to whether the government, in the course of achieving its legislative objectives, has chosen proportional or relative ways of achieving these objectives. In other words, the government has to find a reasonable way to achieve or implement its legislation. So there you have the law of the land on the subject. But what if you prefer a more libertarian stance? Going back to the helmet question, if it's your decision to not wear a helmet, regardless of the reasons, what right does anyone have to tell you to wear one? If we go down the path of being forced to do something because of safety, why even allow things like motorcycles or skydiving or whitewater rafting and hockey? Now, I don't think there's a slam dunk answer to this question. But again, perhaps the focus on individual freedom is where we need to be most skeptical. No one lives in a vacuum, and there is always collateral damage when something tragic happens. If a person is severely hurt in a bike crash, their family, their friends suffer along with them. As I mentioned, the family may depend on this person as a wage earner. They may need expensive medical treatment. So therefore, if we take the libertarian stance, one would have to hope and perhaps assume that the person in question has no family or friends, no binding forces that tie them to society. They would need to be completely and utterly disconnected from society so that if something happened to them, it affected no other person but them. I think you'd have a very difficult time finding someone like that in society. We are all connected. We all have some way that we are binded to another person, whether it be through our work or our family or our friends. Let's shift gears for a bit, and let's talk about vaccines. Anyone who's heard me on Radio Freethinker knows that I have no time for anti-vaccine nonsense. It's dangerous, it's anti-science, and it causes significant harm to our society. For those who don't know, the anti-vaccination movement is largely centered around the disproven notion that vaccines contain dangerous toxins which may be linked to autism. These claims have been thoroughly debunked by scientists all over the world. In fact, many of the studies purported to show a link between vaccines and autism have been discredited with links between the authors and legal firms who try to sue vaccine makers. Many of these links were uncovered in recent years and led to the downfall of architects of the anti-vax movement like Dr. Andrew Wakefield. Yet the myth has persisted and mutated. Claims that vaccines are part of a government mind control plot, sterilization efforts, mass poisonings, and more have all made the rounds in the anti-vaccination camp. They've drummed up so much fear that many parents and communities are now refusing vaccines. And thanks to high-profile anti-science crusaders like Jenny McCarthy, Oprah Winfrey, and Dr. Oz, there is now a large percentage of the population refusing vaccines and turning themselves into walking biohazards. Now, if that sounds harsh, there is a good reason. Anti-vaccination efforts disproportionately hurt children and other vulnerable populations. As immunity rates go down, outbreaks increase. We've seen such outbreaks as whooping cough and measles. In an unvaccinated population, these diseases can carve through them like a hot knife through butter. There are many reasons why people are rejecting vaccines, and not just the anti-science fear-mongering. There are also groups who refuse to get them due to religious reasons. Typically in small, isolated communities, which is where these outbreaks will typically start. However, over the past winter, we've seen measles outbreaks in Vancouver, Ottawa, Calgary, and other major metropolitan communities. These places are not isolated at all. Because of the danger to children, many schools are not allowing students who haven't gotten their vaccines or booster shots back into class. Now here's a question. Why aren't vaccines mandatory? In the same way that you need to get a license to drive a car, why don't you have to get a vaccine? When we talk about personal freedom or personal liberty, vaccines seem to be a perfect example of how you may think that this is a personal decision, that this is something that only affects you. But of course it's not, because you're not an isolated organism in a society. You are interconnected to every single person. Everything you touch or interact with can be a vector to transmit some disease. If you don't get your vaccination for measles and you carry the disease, you can infect dozens of people. It's an incredibly infectious disease. And you might think, well, what's the harm? It's just measles. But for some people, it's very harmful. Just because some of us have working immune systems, are healthy, are young, are in good shape, doesn't mean the rest of society is. The whole purpose of social justice is to recognize that society is not entirely equal. That if all of us make a little bit of effort, we can improve the lives of everybody around us, regardless of their background. Why would we not consider that health to be one of the aspects that someone could be disadvantaged? If those of us who are healthy don't consider our responsibility to make sure that health is shared, that health is something that we're all entitled to, then how are we going to make society better? Back in 2002, the World Health Organization declared Canada measles-free. Well, look at us now. As I mentioned, many schools and jurisdictions are now requiring proof that students have gotten their vaccinations. Beginning in September, Ontario students will have to show proof that they've been vaccinated against chickenpox, whooping cough, and meningococcal diseases before they enter school. Students are already required to prove that they have been immunized against measles, mumps, rubella, tetanus, polio, and diphtheria. What's interesting is that Croatia has had mandatory vaccination laws since 1999. According to government statistics, no occurrence of diphtheria, whooping cough, measles, parotitis, and pulmonariitis, often called polio, have been registered in recent years. While tetanus rates have been reduced by 97%, tuberculosis by 93%, and hepatitis B, with mandatory vaccination against this disease, introduced in 1999, by 65%. Of course, they weren't immune to fear-mongering. More and more parents chose not to vaccinate their children. In 2012, 28 Croatian children didn't receive vaccines. That number shot up by 2013 to 143. The courts decided to take the issue up after 10,000 people signed a petition arguing that vaccination of healthy children posed a health risk. The court put that argument to rest by ruling that these private concerns don't supersede public safety. Quote, "The child's right to health is more than the rights of the parents to make the wrong choice." All children now must receive shots for DPT, diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus, polio, influenza, MMR, that's measles, mumps, and rubella, and tuberculosis, among others. ABC News in America recently reported on the sad case of Abby Peterson, who died at age 6 in 2001 from the chickenpox. Abby's mother chose not to vaccinate her, believing that it would be safer for her to get the disease and build up immunity to it. However, it later turned out that Abby had an additional condition that made her especially vulnerable to diseases. Duffy Peterson, her mother, has since become a vocal proponent of vaccines and has even spoken to Minnesota legislature about passing mandatory vaccination laws. So we've seen the response of having a mandatory law on the books. Safety increases, health and welfare increases. I think it's time that more social justice proponents make vaccinations a priority in your book when it comes to promoting the health and welfare of the people around you. Keep in mind that when people aren't vaccinated, they're vulnerable. Children, people who have immune difficulties, or people who simply don't have the resources or are within the system to get those vaccinations in the first place. If we make a greater effort to promote the science and the reasoning behind vaccinations, we can help make our society a whole lot safer. Further, this is a great example of how a mandatory law that does limit freedoms, I mean, you are required to get a vaccine, that does take away from your right to, you know, say no to it. But look at the benefit. Look at how many people are made safer by the vaccine. Keep in mind that not everybody out there can get the vaccine. People have immune deficiencies. There are additional conditions that can make the vaccine ineffective for you. So for those people, they depend on others getting the vaccine and creating herd immunity, creating enough percentages of populations that are immune so that the disease cannot move through a population and infect everybody. Ultimately, this is a question of the rights of society to remain disease-free, and that surely falls under the category of social justice and the watchful eye of nonprofit organizations. So hopefully more people will speak up, and hopefully we can put more pressure on government to increase these rules for nonprofits and for organizations campaigning for mandatory vaccination. Now, I mentioned that we don't have an interview for today's show. However, I wanted to actually play a portion of a segment that I recorded many, many months ago for my old show, Radio Freethinker. Now, this clip features myself and my co-host, Don McLennigan, who you can still hear on Radio Freethinker, discussing the anti-vaccination movement here locally in Vancouver. I think this is really important because last summer, the university SFU, Simon Fraser University, allowed an anti-vaccination group to use one of their conference rooms for an anti-vaccination conference. And as part of my previous job with CFI, I was out there in the media trying to convince people that this was a very dangerous thing. So I want you to listen to this segment and let me know what you think. You can let us know here on The Sector and or pass along your thoughts to Don over at Radio Freethinker. Let's take a listen now, and I hope you enjoy it.
These speakers are talking to a group of people who will, by not getting their children vaccinated, directly result in the suffering and possible deaths of their children and others at-risk members of the community. I think there is a direct link here, but what they're saying demonstrably false? So let's look at that idea. First, the idea they truly believe it is not really a defense. I suspect many racists have a firm and honest belief in the inferiority of other races, so I don't think ignorance is a defense in this case. Now, is what they're saying demonstrably false, to the point that any reasonable person would know so? And I accept that the onus on this part is on me, and it is a pretty high bar to reach, but I think I do achieve it. So to answer this question, I checked out their website and what they're going to be talking about. So some of the topics include vaccines cause autism, heavy metal poisoning comes from vaccines, vaccines are unphysiological, disease, at least the measles, is a good thing for building your immune system, and aluminum builds up in the body causing brain damage. So willful ignorance causing suffering and death. The claim that vaccines cause autism has been researched extensively by groups in both, quote, the big pharma camp and those out of it. So people who have no vested interest in trying to promote some sort of global conspiracy. There's been statistical analysis that shows there's no link to connect autism with vaccines. Every mechanism claimed by the anti-vax movement has been debunked. This is a lie, and they know it's a lie, or at least they should know it's a lie. Now, heavy metal poisoning from vaccines. Well, you can get heavy metal poisoning if you have a sufficient amount of heavy metal. And the only heavy metal that I seem to be able to track down that they're referring to here is aluminum, which is used as an anti-vagilant.
Adjuvant.
Now, again, we have to be careful here. We're not actually talking about aluminum. We're talking about aluminum hydroxide. Think of the difference between rust and steel. There is no evidence that this is actually toxic in the bloodstream, and there's very controversial evidence that if you applied it directly to the brain cells, there may be an effect. But one could say that if you applied salt directly to the brain cell, it would have some effect as well.
Right.
The other aspect is that if the aluminum builds up in your system, so if you get a buildup of aluminum body, at some point it can become toxic and lead to other complications. There are some now considered to be dubious studies that showed a link between aluminum buildup and Alzheimer's disease, but now this is considered to be a false flag sort of situation. But that said, the amount of aluminum required for this to be a factor is a magnitude of magnitudes order greater than what's found in the vaccinations of children. So again, you know, even if you said that this could happen, there's nowhere near enough for it to happen. And this is well known. This is not like something. So again, willfully false. They also try to discredit vaccines with articles that purport, quote, the whole basis of vaccination is unphysiological. The vast majority of infections enter through the nasal cavity and the gastrointestinal tract. Trying to make the case that it's not even targeting sort of the right areas to sort of elicit a good immune response. And further, that by directing the vaccination directly into the muscle, you're, quote, poisoning the brain with aluminum and actually giving the disease to the child by, quote, circumventing 80% of the body's immune system.
They're
misunderstanding of how the body works is boggling.
Well, you know, that's the thing, because this one article, and I must admit, you know, this is one of
the... That's not even a little wrong. That's, like, a lot wrong.
Well, there was so much gish-galloping, you know, plopping down of disconnected ideas and plonking down the facts that are actually circular and reference and all that, and just outright things that we now know are not true, that it was more like paranoid ranting.
You right. almost expect to hear them talk about the four humors, but that even that seems too intelligent for their rhetoric.
And again, you know, this is an important thing. It's willful, or at least it's dangerously delusional, right? Mm, and I mean, yeah. So I mean, there's a bar to hear. And if they were just ranting about how the Twin Towers was part of some conspiracy, okay, you're an insane conspiracy nut, maybe. But there's no real harm in propagating that idea. But there's a direct link.
Yeah, Don, a good quote that I recall, and I think I've mentioned this before, and it comes from Dr. Stephen Novella, who said that at a certain point, whether you're being dishonest or whether you're just spreading demonstrably false misinformation, that line just blurs at a certain point, and it no longer matters. It no longer matters whether or not you honestly believe this is true, or whether or not you're just lying to get something, because you're doing the same amount of harm.
Well, you know, just to give you an idea of how far this group is, and now I'm gonna be this is directed exactly at the Vaccination Awareness Network, right? So it's at this particular group, and I don't want to tar and feather that every anti-vax group is necessarily as way out there as there, but this one jumped the shark. On their website, they have an article that propagates the conspiracy that AIDS was created and distributed by the World Health Organization as some sort of UN plot. They have they comment or quote research into the H1N vaccine. Well, let me just read you the quote, and you'll see. So documents implicating the CDC, the WHO, numerous vaccine manufacturers, along with government agencies, in collusion with the Rockefeller Trust, Rupert Murdoch, and other media, real estate, and medical industrial moguls, in a genocidal plot to use vaccines, in particular the H1N1 flu vaccine, as a bioweapon to deliberately sicken and depopulate the planet. It boggles the mind that you're allowed to say this sort of stuff in this venue. You know, that it's just it transcends that. And of course, it's ironic because they're actually ignoring some real issues. I mean, if they had come out and, you know, there's a possible link between the H1N vaccine and people who have a genetic disposition to narcolepsy. We've covered that on the show, right? It's not a big thing, but I mean, hey, at least it's something you sort of have a reality to base it on. There's the idea, you know, do mandatory flu vaccines that are only usually about 60 to 70% effective. Should we have that? Okay, I don't agree with it, but I mean, there's at least a real debate to be had there. Even the idea of doing clinical trials and vaccines and methods as to see which is the best to work. I mean, at present, we can't really do that because it's considered unethical to deny a patient the best possible treatment.
Right, exactly.
So to me, this is equivalent to a hate group that's causing real harm and deaths. There is no sense of responsibility, and they are willfully propagating falsehoods and lies. They at least, in this particular group at least, should be banned from public speech, or at least vilified by society, most notably in the case of SFU. If this was Ernst Zundel, I doubt SFU would allow his free speech, and they wouldn't hide behind the idea of free speech as a defense. Free speech should only be denied in very rare and extreme cases. So, I mean, I'm not saying that this is not a black and white, you know, hey, we should do it. But I think, yes, this is one of the cases where it should it's crossed the boundary.
Well, you know, I'll sort of separate myself from some of the opinions of, like, CFI and others that I represent, because I know that there are different points of view on how far should we go in our tolerance of free speech. And I think that's a valid argument to have. But I want to recap my personal opinion that this is not a free speech issue. I personally think that SFU basically got this broom booking and went, are they going to pay the fee? Yes. Are they going to bring in outside food? No. Okay. Stamp approved. I can't prove that, and I may be casting unfair remarks about people, and I apologize if that's the case, but SFU is responding to this like they're saying, well, we're going to let this debate air out. But it's not a debate. They're not sending representatives. They're not presenting a science point of view. They're just letting these people talk about medical wise.
It's not even a science point of view. It's a rational point of view.
Yeah.
I mean, they are saying that gravity does not exist. I mean, they are some of the things they are saying are that far out there.
And I think that the idea that this is a free speech issue also should make us wonder, well, then, is it also a free speech issue when Health Canada says, no, you can't write that homeopathy cures cancer on a piece of medicine? Because that's exactly what they do. They say you cannot lie about medicine in advertising or in the media. So why is it that you can go to a university, lie about vaccines, potentially endanger the people who go there, turn them into walking biohazards, as it were, and say, well, it's free speech? But you're talking about a science issue. Science is not a democracy, as much as we maybe would hope it would be. It is about the consensus of evidence. It is about a rational inquiry into evidence independent of our opinions. And the vaccine issue, particularly the claims they're making, have long been debunked. It's not like they're talking about legitimate questions. I mean, you mentioned there are legitimate concerns with vaccines and that they should, of course, be looking at. But this is mind-boggling conspiracy theories that are not only endangering the people who listen to it, it's endangering everybody who may get whooping cough or something if her immunity falls any lower.
Well, and let's not forget, they have one person at least at this conference who's presenting the idea, at least from her writings and from what I can gather from their propaganda, that we should infect kids with these diseases that killed people in the past because it strengthens their immune system. And actually, you know, if they eat healthy and if they're like good children to begin with, they won't even get these diseases in the first place. And that's so wrong. I mean, one of the problems we have is that vaccines have been so effective, we don't really understand the harm we're doing by allowing them to sort of fade away to a certain degree.
They're victims of their own success.
Yeah. I mean, thousands of people died because we didn't have these vaccines.
Yeah.
You know, and it's criminal. I mean, it is not borderline criminal. It's criminal in my mind. Again, there are shades of gray in this debate. These people, not the shade of gray. They're the black. This is cut and dry. This is, you know,
this is about as clear cut as cases you could make for speech causing harm.
And then you have to go with the other. There's sort of the second idea, because we talked about free speech many times before. And so there's the legal case of free speech, right? But then there's also the social aspect of free speech. And this is where I think you have the most issue with SFU, is that SFU is an academic institution. By allowing this to happen there, there is a certain amount of acceptability, a certain amount of this might actually be plausible, that
tacit approval,
that goes on with this. And where SFU, even if they said, listen, legally we can't deny them, but we denounce what they have to say. I mean, that would have been a perfectly acceptable thing
Say our hands are tied, we have to rent the space to them, but we're going to hold a pro-science conference the next day and invite our entire faculty of health and sciences, who for their right have been outstanding in their support of science. The letter they issued was incredibly strongly worded. I thought it was very good. I think that there's a lot of, I think, you know, the administration should be as embarrassed and horrified as the science departments have been at SFU.
And they should review their procedures for accepting this. When is this conference happening again?
It's today.
It's today?
Yeah, it's actually starting in about like a couple minutes.
So Ethan, have you got your minions to go out there and storm the Palisades? And is there going to be like book burning or something going on?
Yeah, no, the book burning idea didn't really make it off the ground. No, actually, I'm glad you mentioned this, because I did post something to the CFI's Facebook page about this. In the past, we have done things where we've like flyered or handed out information.
Skepticism.
Yeah, at various activities. Over the years, though, we've kind of learned what makes these efforts effective and what makes them sort of waste of time. And this, unfortunately, would be a waste of time, because the layout of SFU is not to our benefit. They're right next to the security office. It's inside private property. And if they kicked us out, we would be banished to the sidewalk, which is really far away from the entrance. So it's like we would just be standing there in the rain, you know, talking to ourselves while people walked around us wouldn't really serve any purpose. The other downside is that the anti-vax community is particularly hostile to criticism. And I don't want to say that every person who does vaccines is going to punch you in the face, but the few times that I actually have interacted with anti-vaxxers have been aggressive conversations. I've been accused of being in the pocket of Big Pharma. I had someone like yell at me, "Who sent you?" I was like, "I came on my own, buddy." Like, but I mean, there's a lot of potential risk for, I think, really heated arguments that will go nowhere, and ultimately, I think, just enrage and cause problems.
And a lot of non sequiturs. I mean, you were talking about before the show about how one of the anti-vaxxers claims to have some sort of credentials for talking about this, and his credentials were he can read and write. I mean, you did it much more excitingly than that, but it's like, what was it? I'm a medical journalist. So what are your credentials? I'm a medical journalist. I'm a medical journalist. So you can read and you can write. That's your qualifications.
Yeah.
So I have one other question, Ethan, for you. And I know we're going to push a break back a little bit here, but I think this is important. Maybe we'll cover it later more intensively. You've been really busy with the press. There's been a lot of press coverage about this. One could make the argument this event would have happened and disappeared and three people would have shown up. But the fact that you have made it, or this thing has made it such a big thing that they've got so much free press that it's going to be so much bigger than it would have been if you just sort of ignored it. Well, what do you say about that?
Well, I think that it's true. We could have just ignored it and hoped it would have passed quietly. But as you mentioned, this is not simply a question of some people saying crazy things. This is a public health risk. And the media, for whatever reason, has in the past been on the side of the anti-vaxxers. They give a platform for people like Jenny McCarthy and Oprah to go out there and say things. We need the media to be more aware of the potential dangers of this. And I think that I've at least been optimistic, and I've had nice conversations with some of the reporters and people that I've talked to have shown to me that the media is catching on, that this is a important issue that they need to shine a light on. They may not like talking to anti-vaxxers and they may not like giving them free publicity, but people need to know what they're saying, and they need to know that the scientific community is not in a state of controversy about this. They have examine the evidence, we know what's going on, and these anti-vaxxers are just spreading misinformation, dangerous misinformation.
But you were telling me, I think before, that actually it gets a bit more complicated because the media sources themselves, I mean, some of them are sort of agnostic and we need to be educated, but some of them have their own biases as well. And I think you were mentioning to me about a cameraman who definitely was on the side of the anti-vaxxers.
Yeah, that was the one strange experience I had. I did one interview with a certain media outlet, and it was kind of strange. They sort of, I guess, kept asking me sort of the same question over and over again, I guess trying to get me to say something different, but it wasn't going to. And then after the interview, we had like a 15-minute conversation where they were asking me about, well, what about the flu shot? It doesn't even work half the time. And I'm like, well, that's not really accurate. And I'm trying to explain the science behind vaccinations. And of course, I'm not a scientist, so I'm not doing a very good job. But I mean, the vibe that I got from them was actually quite hostile. And at the end, they basically just said, well, I disagree. I'm like, okay. I mean, you're certainly allowed to do that. But I mean, it is kind of frustrating. Mm-hmm. But that's been the exception. By and large, the majority of the interactions I've had have been very positive, and I'm quite optimistic about that.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, RX Comics, Red Cat Records, the Regional Assembly of Text, the Rumpus Room, the Wallflower Modern Diner, and Woo Vintage Clothing.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus. Go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you can always count on me.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
And we're back on The Sector. Well, my thanks to Don and past Ethan for appearing on the show. I hope you enjoyed that segment. Again, it was from Radio Free Thinker, and I will post a link on the show notes to the episode in question where you can listen to it in full. And you remember to check out Radio Free Thinker Tuesdays at 3 o'clock and hear Don, and I'll be popping in, actually, next week and the week after, so it should be very exciting. Now, on for today's big question of the week, as we are wrapping up soon. Now, remember, we invite your feedback on the big question. You can communicate your responses via email or online at our website or via Facebook or Twitter. As for the question itself, how successful do you think the nonprofit sector is in making change happen? Now give it some thought. Think about it. What has the nonprofit sector accomplished in the past 50 years of existence? There are lots of areas where the nonprofit sector is working hard, where we have activists who are campaigning and fundraising and trying to make change, whether that's relief of poverty or improvements of science-based medicine or the environment, animal rights, civil liberties. Where do you think we're seeing the most success? What are areas that you think, well, we're just not seeing any success at all, whether progress has been slow or non-existent? Let us know your feedback on this. Remember, you can participate in the big question. Visit us at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com for our website, or you can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/sectorpodcast, or on Twitter, where you can tweet us at sectorpodcast. You can also tweet me, your host, Ethan Clow. I'm on Twitter as well, at Ethan Clow. And if none of those things work for you, try emailing us, sectorpodcast@gmail.com. Well, we are wrapping up for another episode of The Sector. This was episode 4. Thank you so much for joining us, whether you were listening live or downloading the podcast. Remember to find us online at those links I just gave you. Share it with your friends and let everyone know about The Sector. We really do appreciate the feedback and the support that you've been giving us. Well, until next week, thank you for listening. And remember, the nonprofit sector is not going to help itself. Donate, volunteer, help out any way you can. Thank you very much.